This is Nadia from the Relativity Podcast, and you're listening to Discussing Comics.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Discussing Comics. I am Kyle Jones, and I want to welcome back first Clarence Brown. Clarence, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing good, man. Happy to be back on another episode. How are you doing, dude?
I can't complain. Well, I could complain. I could say that I'm sleepy because, as according to the calendar this morning, we had to jump our clocks up a little past midnight, an extra hour. But hey, we get an extra hour in the evening, but I'm kind of like sleepy today. But I'm glad to be here.
Awesome.
So also, welcome back, Ryan Kent. Ryan, how about you? How are you?
Similarly sleepy, but I'm also excited to be here with you guys and excited to talk about what we're going to be talking about.
Well, again, guys, welcome back. Glad to have you on. And I'm going to say right now, for anyone who has not read the Watchmen source material, the comics before Watchmen, seen the 2009 movie, or seen the Watchmen HBO series, I would say put us on pause, go out, read and watch all of those, because from this moment forward, spoilers.
Spoilers. Affirmative. Spoilers. Spoilers. Affirmative. Spoilers.
All right, guys, before we get into our actual review, I would like to play some feedback. This is from our longtime listener and supporter, Matthew. He has sent in some Reed Richards feedback on some comments that we made in our last episode. So we will be right back after our feedback from Matthew.
Hi, guys. Really enjoyed the Dawn of X discussion and the latest Discussing Comics. But there's one thing I wanted to fundamentally disagree with you on, and regarding the Fantastic Four X-Men number one. And I'm coming at this as a parent. Kyle said that that Reed took away Franklin's right to make a decision. I don't agree with that at all. I do think that Mr. Fantastic, the way he went about it was not the best way. It's obviously creates resentment with Franklin to be for him to do something like that, sort of behind Franklin's back. But Franklin does not have the right to make that decision. Yes, as a 15 or 16 year old, however old Franklin is supposed to be right now, yes, he should be starting to make decisions. But there are some decisions that 16 year olds cannot and should not be able to make on their own. And one of those is where they should live. As a parent, I can tell you when my children are that age, they're both younger than that now, but when they're that age, if they come to me and say, I want to go live with this other person over here, I don't care how well I know those people or trust those people, I'm not going to allow that. They have to stay in my house until they're 18. And at that point, they can make their own decision. And that's what Mr. Fantastic says, that when Franklin reaches that age, he can make his own decision about where to live. But at the age Franklin is now, he does not have the right to make his own decision about where and whom he is going to live with. And so I think Mr. Fantastic is fully right and correct in exercising his parental obligations to prevent Franklin from going to live in Krakoa. And the fact that Professor X is approaching Reed about this at this point also taps into my theory that as this gets down the road, we're going to see that Professor X is actually the villain of these stories. So I'm anxious to see how all that pans out. But I don't think Professor X, I think he's become more of the early Magneto, where he may have noble intentions, but he does not have noble methods. Thanks for the discussion on Dawn of X, and I hope you guys will check in with it again as the storyline develops further. Thanks.
Awesome, Matthew. Thank you for that feedback. And as always, we appreciate people sending that in. And Kyle, tell people where they can actually send in feedback like Matthew to the show.
All right. You can send in feedback to discussingcomics@gmail.com. And I guess I could say, if you're listening to this episode, chances are you have already experienced the Watchmen as a whole. So maybe a spoiler warning wasn't a appropriate, but hey, I love saying spoilers. Ryan Kent, I'm going to turn it over to you at this point because I want to talk about the source material, and you, my friend, are the most versed in the source material. So kind of walk us through, what is Watchmen? Where did it come from?
Okay, mid-80s, or I should say early 80s, DC Comics purchased Charlton Comics, a smaller publishing brand that had mostly wasn't even doing anything anymore. So they bought the rights to a bunch of characters that you probably know more for their DC uses now, like Captain Atom and Blue Beetle and The Question. Purchased all those characters and really didn't know what to do with them. So they approached Alan Moore for ideas on what to do with them. And he came back with a script that had a lot of very violent sexual real world themes. And they basically looked at it and said, "We love this, but we can't let you do this to our characters." So he went out and he created characters that basically matched up right on with everything, where, you know, Rorschach is The Question and Dr. Manhattan is Captain Atom, and came back and put out 12 issues, him and Dave Gibbons. Basically changed comics forever. Their idea was, what if these people were in the real world? What if there was one superhero, and how would that affect everything going forward? And you really see the darker side of the human psyche in that as well. So it's come out. It's been in print ever since. It's never gone out of print in the last 30 some odd years. Still being read all over the world today. Time magazine has named it one of its 100 great American novels of the 20th century. Not just graphic novels, but any novel. It's incredibly high regard. I think it's well deserved. You know, I think it is basically the seminal comic book of our age.
So what was your introduction? So when were you first introduced to Watchmen, and why did you become a fan? Because just based on hearing you, I can hear that there's some like passion about it. So you obviously, I think, like it. So where was your introduction to Watchmen?
I read Watchmen first when I was in high school. Really didn't understand it. I saw what made it good, but not really maybe what made it special. And then I came back, and I would say in my early 20s, and revisited and really took the time to see how things were done with the 9-panel grid, and how you can really see how that can be an interesting obstacle for the writer and artist to overcome, where if you're not laying out the story, how do you construct stories so it's still compelling? And I just feel like every time you go back to it, you find something different. So I try to return to it about once a year and really dig in and try to find something to focus on that isn't, you know, the same old stuff.
Speaking of not the same old stuff, DC published a set of miniseries or one-shots about probably, I think, about 10 or 15 years ago called Before Watchmen. Were you a fan of that?
Yes and no. Kind of pick your poison there. I think there's some good and some bad. I didn't really care for maybe the Rorschach ones or the comedian ones, but the ones that Darwin Cook did, specifically his Before Watchmen Minutemen one, I thought was pretty spectacular and worthy of being a predecessor to Watchmen, or in the same conversation as Watchmen, worthy of being part of the world. He also did another one with Amanda Conner, the Silk Spectre one, about a young Silk Spectre and her relationship with her mother, that I thought was particularly great. But other than that, the other ones I thought were kind of forgettable. But if you pick and choose, they can really be a nice companion piece to the original text.
Let's jump up into the year 2009, and we have Watchmen finally arrive on the big screen. So Clarence, I'm going to point this one to you. Have you ever seen the Watchmen movie?
Yes. And actually, I went to the movies to see it when it came out. But honestly, it was so forgettable to me that I didn't remember anything about it going into the HBO show. So, yeah, I mean, I saw it at the time, but it didn't really stick with me or jump out to me as something as significant as it should have been. Zack Snyder. So I know you love that, Cal. But you know, I mean, I thought it was fine at the time, but just didn't echo in my psyche from there on out.
So Ryan, what about you? And I'm purposely not giving any of my feedback until I hear what Ryan thinks about this movie. What did you think of the movie interpretation?
Well, I remember getting very excited for it because it came out a weird time of year. It came out in March, but it was the March after The Dark Knight came out. So I thought we had really turned a corner into some dark, realistic, really high quality comic book movies. And in a way we did, but Watchmen was not it. Forgettable, I think, like Clarence said, or, you know, not really leaving a lasting impression is a good way to describe it. I do not love the movie in any way. Rorschach's okay, but the rest of it wasn't really for me.
All right. So according to the write-up on Wikipedia, it says that the film polarized fans and critics. The style was praised, but Snyder was accused of making an action film that lacked the wit of the comic. It's interesting that, once again, Snyder does a comic book movie that fans seem polarized about. They either praise how cinematic and how his style is, but he ultimately seems to focus on style over substance, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
You know, I will quote Clarence in saying that it was forgettable. And unfortunately for me, my introduction to Watchmen was watching the movie and then going back and reading the comic and, you know, reading, you know, the trade paperback. And having read or seen the movie first, I think my judgment was, I don't want to say clouded, but, clouded because that's, maybe that is the word. Because I just was bored throughout the entire movie. You know, don't know if I've ever seen another movie that I was that bored in, maybe.
But so that makes me want to ask the question. Is the source material really aimed to be that exciting? Because I haven't read the core book, but I have seen a lot of the graphic comics explaining what's going on in the books. And from what I've experienced from that, it seems like a very dark and not anything really suited to have be a fun, you know, movie material. So I'd like to hear you guys' thoughts on that.
Very good question. Ryan, what do you think?
I don't think this story is meant to be a fun read. It's supposed to be an important and kind of a deconstruction. I know we use that word quite often, but it is a deconstruction of the superhero genre where there are heroes in here that do terrible things. There are heroes that kill and rape, and it's really meant to be a meditation on what these characters would be like in the world today instead of the glossy version that we all see in our comic books. It was considered kind of widely unadaptable for a long time, and I think it's meant to be read in a book, this story, because there are issues here, like kind of one of the more famous issues of the 12-issue arc is called Fearful Symmetry, where, you know, if you start from the first panel and you start at the rear panel, they're almost the same until it's almost like a mirror image of a comic. As you read through it, it hits a point in the middle where it then backs off and goes back the opposite way so they almost meet in the middle. I feel like I'm not doing a good job describing it, but it's something that can only really be done in a comic book, in the comic book medium, that I don't think can be translated to film all that well. So I feel like if you're trying to adapt the original material, it just seems like there's not a good way to do it. They were against themselves from the beginning.
Yeah. Do you think it's better suited for a, even just talking about the original material in particular, do you think that's better suited for a series rather than a movie? I think of another show that this reminds me of is The Boys. Not so much in the actual story of the series, but in the darkness that we see coming from the heroes.
I think a show, if you were going to do a direct adaptation of the source material, I think you would almost have to do it as 12-hour-long shows. I mean, I thought that's what Damon Lindelof was going to do when the show was announced. But it's such a deep text, and there's so much that the movie has to gloss over, because even the director's cut, I think, is 3 hours long, and it's just excluding tons of important stuff. If you really want to get the full breadth of everything in this book, you would have to dedicate a large sum of time and probably a large sum of materials to get it done correctly.
Yep, I would second that, and that was actually going to be what I was thinking, and I'm glad you asked that question, Clarence, is I would wonder if HBO or, you know, Cinemax or Showtime at the time would have said, hey, let's make a series out of this, that it would have been much, much better. I think it's focused on the stylization too much, and your characters got lost in translation. Now, one thing I did not appreciate about The Watchmen as the story context goes was it seemed like after Watchmen was such a commercial success in the book, then every comic book in the 90s seemed to take precedent from that and be, well, how can we deconstruct our heroes? How can we be grim and gritty? It seemed to me to start this along with The Dark Knight Returns, this whole wave of let's be gritty and grim in our comic books. Do you guys agree with that?
I certainly do. I think that the industry took the wrong lessons from Watchmen, basically. They didn't take the character work or the deep thinking about these themes. They just kind of took, well, everyone likes dark and gritty. Let's make everything dark and gritty. And you're right. It just kind of, a cloud hung over the industry for, I would say, close to 10 years after those books came out. Because it wasn't until the late 90s where you really started to see that darkness and that overwhelming grim, gritty attitude just kind of finally get pushed back away.
The best analogy I could give to that is at one point in the 90s, The Punisher, I think, had at least 4 to 5 titles on the racks at any point in time. So let's jump up, unless you guys have anything else about the source material books or about the 2009 movie. I say let's jump into 2019 and talk about the Watchmen series. What do you guys say?
Yeah, let's do it.
Sounds good.
Awesome. So 2019, HBO, Watchmen series. It's a 9-episode series that was intended to be at first, I believe, an ongoing series, but then turned into a 9-episode mini series. So some review, and Clarence, I'll let you take this first. What did you think overall of the series?
Oh man, so much to say about this. So, first of all, let me preface with saying that I wasn't even remotely into watching this. It's one of those shows that very much had a social media following. I think it was trending, you know, every time a new episode come out. And a friend of mine, a female programmer that works with me, brought this up as a series I should watch. And, you know, I didn't even know she was really into superhero stuff. Getting that suggestion made me actually go and, you know, take the time to watch it. And another thing, I think it was kind of trending on Black Twitter for a while there. Black Twitter's a thing. So, I was kind of shocked that I was getting all these people saying that it's worth watching. But I will say after diving in and getting into it, it definitely went in directions I was not expecting it to go in at all. But I think by the end of it, it came closer to a story that, you know, I kind of was expecting, and very much echoes the story, the Watchmen story of the past. And going in, I didn't know that this was a sequel. So it's a sequel to Watchmen. So yeah, I ultimately enjoyed it, I think, though. What about you guys?
I was excited for it because when I first heard about it, I thought they were just adapting the book. And then I found out that wasn't it, and I was okay. So I kind of put off watching it for a little bit. But the second I started watching it, I was pretty hooked. Similar to what Clarence said, it really does go in directions you're not expecting. I recently just rewatched the first episode after completing the series, and where you see where it starts and where it ends, it's pretty crazy that they were able to get the story there. But I really enjoyed this series. I thought it had a lot of important things to say about the kind of the current state of America. And I said to a friend that I kind of feel is the original Watchmen, you know, Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons, they're both British people. So it was kind of a British person's critique of the American superhero. And I feel like this show was very much more an American person critique of America. So I really enjoyed it. So what did you think?
When I heard they were making this series, and they were, you know, it was like this big thing. I remember the first trailer I think we got was somewhere, maybe even the finale night of Game of Thrones. And I'm like, no, this is not the new Game of Thrones. And I had absolutely zero, zilch, none interest in even thinking about watching this because A, I thought the source material I didn't like, and B, I didn't like the movie. So C equaled I didn't think I would care to watch the series. That said, a certain person named Clarence Brown said he was watching it, and I have learned The Walking Dead to listen to Clarence Brown. So I watched this series. Absolutely not what I was expecting. I liked it. Bottom line, I enjoyed watching it. I was actually kind of binge watching it. Couldn't stop watching it. So very, very good. Very, very good. So let's get into it. Let's talk about the way they set it up. And one of you, and I think it was Clarence, I think you said you didn't realize this was a sequel. I'm going to say, and Ryan, I want your opinion on this. I'm going to say that this could have completely stood on its own 2 feet with the references that it had to Watchmen, but be a story that was totally on its own, that it could have stood without saying, oh, well, it's the Watchmen. I think it was that well written. What say you?
I agree. I think there's enough here for you to really follow, kind of put together the context clues of what this story is building on. I just think it is a much richer experience if you have the book knowledge and you know, okay, oh, this person's coming in. That's Silk Spectre from before. You know, there are these characters that you just have a little bit more ground. But I do agree that it did a good enough job and a really masterful job of weaving in like little world building things that, you know, allude to the bigger world of Watchmen. So I think it stands on its own just fine.
All right. We find out at the very beginning of this something called the Black Wall Street Massacre of 1921. And Clarence, you and I and our friend and co-host Lee Shackelford have often said that we really enjoy episodes of Doctor Who on our Discussing Who podcast, where it teaches us something about history. Were you, and I'm actually throwing this out to both of you, but Clarence, were you familiar with this event prior to watching this series?
Yes, I did know about it already. But that being said, you know, again, coming to watch Watchmen in the first minutes of the first episode, you get it's this very dramatic massacre and people running for their lives through the streets of Oklahoma. So yeah, it definitely was a weird introduction to a Watchmen show, and kind of, I think for me, it was kind of hard to gauge what was going to come next from that, because you really, I'm like, what am I in for here? Like, what is this even about? But, you know, strangely enough, they do bring it all around by the end. So what about you guys?
It's something that I had heard of, but, you know, shamefully on my end, I didn't know that much more about it until I saw this episode. It's not something that's talked about in schools. It's not something that, you know, I ever was taught about in my education. So watching this and then going and doing the subsequent research, it really opened my eyes to something that I didn't even know was ever a thing. So, and starting the series off that way, you're right. It really pushes you back on your heels. It really says, okay, if we're going to go here and we're going to talk about this difficult truth, this black eye on this country, that, you know, we're going to go other places as well. So I thought it was really effective way to get us engaged in the story.
So I'm going to pick up on something you said, Ryan, which is it's a kind of like a mini commentary on our own education system here in the U.S. because unlike the two of you, I had never heard of this before. And that is shameful on my own part for having not somehow discovered it. But it's also shameful in the way that this is, for lack of a better term, or actually a very appropriate term, that our education system in many ways is whitewashed. You know, it's
100%
totally, you know, left out, because I remember, just as a side note, we spent probably 2 9-weeks in the 9-week terms on the First and Second World War. And I remember in my high school history, American history class, we probably spent 2 or 3 days, if maybe a week, on the civil rights movement. So 2 9-weeks, less than a week. That right there shows why this was just kind of whitewashed out of history. That being said, I am ashamed that I didn't know it, but at least I did learn something from this. And that was kind of what hooked me in to wanting to watch more, was because, A, off the bat, I'm learning something about history that I didn't know. So that kind of, me being a history buff, I love history, it just kind of pulled me in.
Yeah, well that's what gave me reservations about. I'm like, is this a good way for a show that you're trying to popularize, that you want people to come in to watch, hitting them with this gut punch from the first 20 minutes of the show? Is that a good way to bring people in? I don't know. I guess it worked, but.
Well, let me pose that question a little step further, and I'll ask you this, you know, both of you this question. Is this show for everybody?
I could say, I mean, I guess I'd answer it this way then. Is this show Should the show be watched by everybody? Yes, I think it is needed by everybody. I don't think everybody can sit down and enjoy this show. I think this show tackles a lot of hard truths. It kind of looks some of the uglier parts of American history in its eye and makes you reckon with them. So I think everyone should watch it, but I can see how there are a group of people similar, like what Clarence said, who will be turned off by watching this show.
So I know the original Watchmen series had a very similar effect. It was either you loved it or you hated it. I know it did very well as far as sales at the time, but can you tell us like some of the big reservations people had about that one as well? Because I heard it's could be a very hard read as well.
If you're going the history route about it, I mean, the book came out 15 years, not even, after Vietnam, and it goes back and has a very harsh look at American politics and American tendencies in Vietnam, which I think is a very good part of this country's history to go back and look at. There's scenes in there where the comedian who is, you know, Laurie in this series, his father, you know, he meets a woman who he impregnated in Vietnam, and when she presses him at all, he kills her cold hearted.
Yeah,
and that is really, yeah, it happens in the movie too. But that, like, stories like that, if you go back and get out of the fifth grade history books and read about Vietnam, there was a lot of terrors that American soldiers did over there, inflicted on the people, burned down their villages, raped and pillaged like they were, you know, conquerors, essentially. So there's a lot of that book that just kind of makes you look in the face of what these events are. There isn't a Black Wall Street, Tulsa, Oklahoma moment, but there are a lot of little things sprinkled about, and there are a lot of scenes that are very hard to watch, or I guess read in this sense, that are very unflinching.
Yeah, I would add to that, it goes against, and remember when this was published, this was right on the heels or about the time that we have Crisis on Infinite Earths, and this is, you know, a time in comic books where I think there is a start of a shift toward more, and I don't want to say adult as in the content, but the audience is being treated more as adults rather than, you know, Superman flying around moving planets and, you know, with his super bunny or whatever, you know, made case may be. It was camp was going away, the age of all the campy stuff, and you were getting into more mature audiences and treating them like young adults or treating them like kids that had read comic books in the 50s and 60s, and now they're adults in the 70s and 80s. So I think you're getting into that. But this is also during the time where the comic code was still in effect. And Ryan, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I don't think this book carried the comic code.
No, it did not. Neither did The Dark Knight. And I want to say neither did Daredevil Born Again. All three of those books that I kind of think of in the same breath around this time, you're right. They matched with an aging readership around this time. You know, there's less kids coming into the, you know, comic book stores. It's more people who'd been reading in the 60s and 70s, but now they were older. And these books were directly aimed at the generation that had grew up reading superheroes, but was ready for whatever the next step was. And that's what this book was supposed to be.
All right. So, guys, I want to ask you a question about the police. And, you know, we don't have your traditional, like we did in The Boys. You had this similar story where you have these superheroes that are, for lack of a better word, they are celebrities, and you see a darker side of superheroics. But with this, we don't have your traditional costumed superheroes. What you do have is costumed police. What did you guys think about this, the police being able to hide their faces from the public? What were your thoughts with that?
I found that very interesting. When you have this group of people, I think they're called the Rorschachs, that are aiming for cops, or any group for that matter, that are aiming for cops. And, you know, if I see your face or see your name, I can track you down. And, you know, you have all other types of implications from that as far as knowing their family. And that's the biggest thing, I guess it would be, knowing someone's family and tagging them directly. It's something you don't really think about with police officers today, because the way we think of police is of being on such a high pedestal, and that they're just doing their jobs. They're servants for us to try to keep everything in order. So the attitude that they have in the show is definitely not what we have here today. But if you really think about it, you know, seeing someone's face, being able to track them down and know where they live, it's a very scary thing. And especially for the jobs that a police officer does. If you think the other side, for a criminal, his face being seen is pretty much, you know, that's the end for him. So, yeah, I like how they kind of flip that on his head. And I think in this world, having them wear masks is a good idea. You know, I liked how they flipped it there. And it was interesting to see that play out.
I thought it was a really cool concept. We kind of take it for granted as avid comic book readers. But if you read, you know, any Superman or Spider-Man comic from before this was published, they always lament because they can't take off their mask and let people know who they are because their families will be in danger. And they kind of took that and applied it to police in this. And you really see what that the horror that that can wreak on people who, you know, when they have this coordinated attack on all the police, you know, you understand the reason to put on the masks. And I really think masks and identity is a big theme throughout this entire show, especially when you get into the Hooded Justice episodes and you see that he is wearing masks on masks on masks and hiding his identity deeper and deeper within himself. I thought just setting that from the first scene after the Tulsa, Oklahoma scene, where you see that super high tension of the police officer pulling up behind that man in the truck and seeing all of that, you really get a sense that this isn't our world. This is this very distinct world, but I just really loved the visual look of everyone in their masks, too. I thought it looked incredible.
Yep. I like the fact that it did give you the costumed vigilante or the, you know, you had the superhero look, because each of the officers that we got to meet, they were able to custom their police identity to their own individuality. So I think we got the costumed heroes without having the costumed heroes. That said, I would be curious to have known if this would have been an extended, you know, series that went on from, you know, season one, season two, et cetera, that if we would have gotten into a story about where the police, even though we do put them on a pedestal, there are still some bad cops. And you would have seen maybe in a subsequent series where having the mask gives you the ability to hide your identity to abuse your power, you know, but I don't think that fell within the subplot and the subtext of everything that was going on in this. But I do think it was a very interesting way to put mask into the whole thing.
Yeah, totally. I agree.
Totally.
All right. So what did you guys think of the idea that the police chief basically gets killed in the first episode? Were you guys expecting that?
I sure wasn't. I told my friend they Ned Starked us. They did exactly what they kind of low level Ned Starked us by really taking this. Because Don Johnson, you know, he's a famous actor in his own right, and he was touted in all the promotional material, and they take him off the board almost immediately. I thought that was a really great subversion of expectation.
Yeah, I think they do a really good thing of not allowing us as the viewer to really know who the protagonists and the antagonists are in this series till we get well within it. And, you know, once you from the jump, you think he's the guy, you know, he's coming off as the good guy here. We're going to follow him. He's going to, you know, do the right thing. But the story just gets deeper and deeper as we go on, and it leads you down a bunch of different paths to really, you don't know what's going on until close to the end there. But again, very interesting. I'm still trying to completely understand the bigger story around him and the senator. Still trying to get their exact motivation. Maybe we could talk about that.
But all right. I think we can. And let me ask this question to kind of lead into that. What did you guys think of the revelation that he has this basic old school Klan outfit in his, you know, hidden in his wardrobe?
Well, to me, it just shows that people can really put on a show, man. I mean, from him to his wife, who was, you know, she knew everything that was going on. And even like I just mentioned with the senator, they are trying to push these chess pieces for him to be president eventually, I think is what they were going for. To just maintain power in general from the shadows. And then you have the whole mind control thing, which, you know, I'm not sure I understand that either, but It just goes in so many directions, man.
All right. So, Ryan, what do you think of this hidden clan outfit that we find later in the story?
I thought it was incredibly compelling because the first episode ends with his death, and then they don't even hold this revelation back another episode. In the second episode, you find out, I guess, that his, you know, again, going back to the mask, his mask is his face he wears every day. But I feel like who he really is was hidden in his closet this whole time. And because they subverted your expectations, you wonder, it's like, okay, so what is, I, at least for me, you know, I thought, okay, is this some kind of setup? Is this something that, you know, I don't know what it really is? Am I jumping to the conclusions they want me to? But he really is this reprehensible person that I just thought it was super compelling and a great way to push the story forward. Once that revelation is made, I was the first episode got me interested. I feel like that revelation really got me hooked. That was where I went from, okay, I have to really make sure I finish this series as quickly as possible.
And I think we got a lot of the revelation of who he was through his wife. I think I would have enjoyed like a flashback or something of him specifically to kind of give us another look at who he actually was.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I want to comment real quick on your question, Clarence, about where the two, him and the senator, and how they fell in to the bigger picture. So here's how I framed the two of them in my mind. I saw him as being more of the type of white person who says, oh, well, this is heritage and not hate. You know, and that's their argument about whatever they're arguing about or trying to be pro about is, oh, well, this is our heritage and it's not all about hate. And they do progress society in some ways, but they seem to always wind up on top. You know, they may progress society and push it in a right direction, but not far enough to where I'm not the person on the top. So that's kind of what he represented to me was, I'm going to push it. I'm going to, you know, extend, but I'm not going to put it to where I'm not going to be sitting up there on top. The flip of that is the senator. And I think this was a commentary on our, whether you're Republican or whether you're Democrat, it's you're in your seat of power. And whatever your seat of power is, you don't want to lose that. And I think that was the commentary it was giving, whether you're, like I said, Democrat, whether you're Republican, and you're looking more into how do I advance my power to stay in power. And in this case, it just so happened to be I'm advancing my perceived powers because my skin is white and I'm going to remain and power, and I'm going to do whatever I have. So that's how my brain kind of saw those two individuals. Curious if you guys agree or disagree, and if so, what were your perceptions?
I think, just based on what we saw, I don't know, I got the vibes that his wife was actually more evil than he was.
Yeah.
I really felt like, maybe not the mastermind, but she was as involved as the senator, and I believe more than even Judd was. I feel like, you know, when you talk about the heritage and stuff like that, I feel like that's, you know, a similar argument that we will have all the time in this country. Again, where, you know, the Confederate flag means something to a large portion of this country that, you know, they claim is heritage and all that. But it also upsets a large number of people. And quite understandably, I feel like it's kind of playing off of that or that. I don't know. I really felt that it was an interesting commentary on where a lot of things sat today.
Yeah, and also think like when you talk about the senator, of course, we know what he tries. I said president earlier, but actually he's trying to become Mr. Manhattan by the end of the series. So I think that also might be a alluding to the previous graphic novel to where I think wasn't there a lot of complaints about Mr. Manhattan not doing enough, having all these powers, but not doing enough to make the world a better place? And that's kind of his stance, is saying that I can do it better. Give me the powers. And so he's seeking power by the end of it, obviously. So
cool. So let's kind of switch away and let's talk about Angela Abar. This was a character played by Regina King. And it to me, she introduced us to a brand new world of Watchmen because we saw the story through her eyes. So, Clarence, what was your thought? What did you like or dislike about Angela?
I don't know. I don't think I disliked anything about her. I thought I loved how she had this event, you know, and it changed the type of cop she had to be because she really just liked being a police officer, and she had to actually become Sister Knight to continue her job. And of course, everybody was wearing masks by then. But I mean, I just found her whole story really compelling. And when we talk about when she meets Dr. Manhattan and just that whole conversation and how he's able to be in two times at once because of who he is, I love that whole conversation of how she fell in love with him, was actually told to fall in love with him, and she really does. So, yeah, I believe so much of what she is in this series is because of him. But that being said, I like the toughness of her. She was able to go home and be a mom, but when the time came, she was able to flip it and become this character and do her job that she's continued to love to do. So
I really enjoyed Angela's character. I think Sister Knight, just real quick, the design of that character and that costume, I thought was right at home with the rest of the Watchmen designs. And she looks like she came straight out of the pages. I love her origin, where everything that happens with her and her childhood, and also where she got the Sister Knight idea, where she got I don't know, I just love, because I really feel like this show, what they did was they started with what would this world be like 35 years after the end of the book, and you see that sprinkled throughout the thing. But part of that is Vietnam being a state, and this kind of secondary history where after Vietnam became a state, a bunch of people moved over there, but they weren't looked at as in a favorable light to the locals. You know, they were seen as invaders still. So seeing how she grew up in that environment and then kind of was treated as an outsider over there and came back over here and everything else, that I just really found everything about her character super compelling. I think it's interesting that she is a mother, even though she really never wanted to be one, but she's doing it because it's the right thing to do. I think that's like something that is heroic in everyday life that people do. And seeing her do that, it was just a great shorthand for showing what a great character she was.
Speaking of great characters, what did you think of, we see the old man and he's sitting in the wheelchair and he's under the police chief that he just acclaims to kill. And then throughout the course of the story, because of something called nostalgia, Angela gets to relive this story, and we hear about his entire story of being Hooded Justice. So what did you think of her grandfather, Will, and his story? So who wants to take that? Either one of you.
So help me out. Like, why did he kill him? I'm still not sure I know. It's been a while since I've seen this.
The best way that I understand, and this might be wrong, but when in 2009, when Dr. Manhattan disguised as, forgetting his name, Calvin. Yes. When he disguises him, he knows everything that's going to happen. So when he goes and talks to Will Reeves, Hooded Justice, and, you know, this is what's going to happen in 10 years. And I think he gives him all of that important information that, you know, Judd Crawford, the police chief, is essentially the leader of this organization. And that's where he gets that information.
Yeah. And now I'm remembering, because you have the conversation at the pool where Angela's talking to Dr. Manhattan, and she's talking to her father in the past, her grandfather in the past. And she mentions, why did you kill the police chief? He says, who's the police chief? Who's this guy? You know,
and you know what went through my head, right?
Timey-wimey.
Wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey. Yeah.
Interesting.
So let's go back. I'm curious. I want to hear a little bit about her grandfather's story. So we see him back in 1938, and he's in the New York Police Department, but it's a layered, I would say, police department, meaning, yes, he's a cop. Yes, he has the badge, but he really doesn't have the power to take down anybody. Meaning, I took it more so as you're a black cop. You can go and arrest anyone who's black, but if you mess with somebody who's white, hands off. Did you guys get the same thing?
Yeah. He was definitely a cop of his time. You know, that that definitely we saw that play out. But I think what was so hard about seeing him have to struggle as a police officer, you know, from the very opening moments of this series, we see where he's looking at this movie with his mother playing the piano. And I forget the character's name and the movie he's looking at, but he's like the sheriff of Tulsa, the black guy keeping justice on the countryside of Oklahoma.
And Bass Reeves.
Bass Reeves. That's core to who he is. And he wants to go out and do that. But, you know, it's just so funny once you have all these things in your head about how you're going to go out here and do this thing and be this great police officer. And like instantly, like you said, Cal, he's met up with some troubles, so to speak, in trying to do his job. So, yeah, that was really hard to take, to see that he couldn't do the job he really wanted to do with passion, you know.
I thought this was one of the best parts of the show, honestly, as a reader of the original Watchmen, because really, Hooded Justice is the only character you don't learn about in some of the text somewhere. He's kind of, when you read Watchmen, Hollis Mason, the original Night Owl, has written this book under the hood, kind of explaining his time as Night Owl, and he talks about everyone else, but Hooded Justice was always this vague figure that was always talked about with a bunch of reverence, but you really don't know anything about him. And he's kind of hinted at who he is in the Minutemen, but that turns out to be, in the Minutemen series, but that turns out to be kind of a red herring. So seeing this as the inspiration for how the original crime fighter put on the mask, and you're right, it is heartbreaking watching those scenes of him. You know, he wants to do good. He's obsessed with justice. He's watched these old Bass Reeves, you know, silent movies, and he has that embedded in him that is important. And when he tries, he is just basically ineffective. He's there to be almost mocked by everyone else. It's heartbreaking to watch. So when you see him almost get lynched and then the channel that rage into saving people, you understand why someone like that would put on a mask and seek out justice, and how that could beget everything else that happens in this series, and kind of starting off the generation of costume adventurers. I thought that was super compelling, and I thought that episode was about as masterful a TV episode as I've ever seen.
Well, was that the one-shot episode?
The one where she's got all of his memories and is like going back through them and everything.
And you know, what I found to be is the ironic irony, or the biggest thing about that, was you have Hooded Justice, and he basically puts on makeup, making him appear white under the hood. So you have this black man who puts on this hood that looks very similar to a, you know, KKK hood, and has this rope around him, Hooded Justice. But yet this, and there is so much reverence that is given to him, even when he is asked to join the Minutemen, as they were called, is ultimately someone that if they knew who Hooded Justice was, I would love to have seen their faces if he would have taken the mask off and be like, hey, I'm Hooded Justice.
They were totally fine with a white man running around and doing that, but if they had found out it was a black man under that mask going out and administering justice to these white people, he would have been caught within the day.
Yeah.
It just really shows the hypocrisy of how they acted around him.
Yeah, it even seemed as if the Minutemen were using him a little bit. It seemed like he was very upset with how he was treated within that group as well. So
yeah,
and
no, go ahead.
I just also want to point. I mean, we're talking a lot about his race in this conversation, but his sexuality also comes into play, and you find out that he was this closeted gay man that really was just another thing that he was hiding from even the people closest to him. So it's similar to how the Minutemen were using him. You can also see how Captain Metropolis was using him for more, you know, for pleasure, but didn't really see him as an equal or as someone to be a partner in fighting crime.
Yep. And, you know, even if you would have labeled him as bisexual, regardless whether had he been gay, whether he had been bisexual, the point that you just made rang true, because I think we saw that in the point where he calls asking for the Minutemen's help, and Captain Metropolis basically, you know, kind of just says, oh no, you know, this is not something that we get into, and it kind of brushed him off some. But yet this is your illustrious leader, and I think for him that was that aha light bulb moment to say, yep, you guys are using me too. And that was sad.
It broke him. You see his eyes almost go dead in that moment, and he becomes just a weapon of justice as he walks through, not even hesitating one bit to just murder everyone involved in that operation.
Yeah, and I'll just throw a shout out to that. I mentioned this a second ago, but there was a one-shot episode one camera shot episode, even though, you know, we know it's fake, but it was very well, technically brilliant, I would say, in the style of a Birdman, or I think there's been a few more movies where it's been one shot like that. So I really love that episode stylistically.
Sweet. Let's get up to the point to where we've met this character named Lady True. What were your thoughts on Lady True?
I thought she was awesome. I thought just a really great, again, just kind of thinking about what would have gone on in this world in the last 35 years, and just her origin story, everything about her, her mannerisms. I thought she was menacing while being maybe the quote unquote meekest character on the screen. You know, she wasn't physically intimidating, but she was in charge of almost every single moment she was on screen. And you really felt the magnitude of that character from the second she stepped on screen.
Yeah. When we get the bigger story of who she is, it makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense. But at first I'm like, what is even going on here? But yeah, her origin is really interesting, and her child, which is her mother.
Her mother child.
Yeah. So yeah, so many things about this character, and I don't know. I'm still trying to figure. I keep asking questions. We're reviewing this. So what was it with her buying the land? Was it just to build the watchtower?
I think she knew exactly when the rocket that had Ozymandias was coming back to Earth, and she needed to buy it. That's what that time, that, you know, that hourglass was. You have 3 minutes before you're going to own this thing that's going to land on your land, and I can't have that happen. So I have to offer you a deal you can't refuse, and you have to take it right now, because she wanted ownership of Ozymandias.
That makes sense.
Okay. And Clarence, to make you feel better, I did not understand that at all either. And I understood it whenever I was doing research for this a little earlier this afternoon, because it basically laid out what Ryan just said, because I was like, okay, that didn't really make a lot of sense.
And to make you both feel better, I didn't know that until I did a lot of research myself and YouTube explanations and stuff like that. So it is a little, the story is definitely hard to follow. You have to, there's a lot of mental bandwidth you have to be able to go back and know that. I wouldn't have known that if I didn't do that myself either.
Yeah, the second watch would really help, because we don't see the moment that he leaves the moon until the end of the series. But you do see his statue standing in the at the tower the whole, you know, throughout the series. So, you know, it's definitely jumping all over the place.
So let's talk about him for a moment, because there were times where I felt like his story was just filler into the entire main story, meaning it could have been easily cut out and really not made a difference. Did you guys feel that same, or you enjoy and think that it added a lot of whatever to it?
With him torturing these poor souls on the moon? His story could have been cut out, I think. I really think it could have. Now, it does tie into Lady True's, Miss True's, but other than that, we really didn't need him in the series, I don't think.
I agree with that. What do you say, Ryan?
I think that from a story point of view, you could rewrite the story where he's not in it. I wouldn't enjoy that, though, because I think Jeremy Irons in this show was delightful. I thought he was, I don't want to say hilarious, but he was just hamming it up the entire time in the perfect way. He was so blowvial and so, you know, over the top and everything. And then, because you're right, I did not connect with that story when I was first watching it. It was only after I realized at the end, or I didn't realize, it was told to me, because like I said, this, I had to do a lot of research myself. But every time you see him is another year on Europa. Like the first episode is after 1 year, the second episode is after 2 years. And I went back and rewatched all the scenes with that knowledge, and it made all the difference in the world for me.
Interesting.
And that's cool if there is something where you can go back and watch, you know, and get more out of it. So that's cool.
Yeah, I just ultimately, I didn't like seeing him torture those beings that Dr. May had made there on the
His
moon.
His created beings, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. He had a purpose. He had a purpose to make his little sign, because he knew the satellite was passing at a certain time. Right. But yeah.
Ozymandias' whole thing in the book is, He will kill whomever he needs to, including 3 million people in New York, for the greater good. So in his mind, he thinks he's the most important thing in the world. So he thinks him getting back to Earth is the most important thing in the world. So these beings lesser than him, he doesn't care about their suffering. which I'm agreeing with you that makes him not a great protagonist, but I think that's some of the thinking behind what he was doing.
And had Dr. Manhattan not been in this state, I think he would have helped his creations out there a little bit, because he really tortured those things.
All right.
Absolutely.
So let me ask you guys a question about Dr. Manhattan. We find out at the end that Calvin, who I think, by the way, was a cool name to name her husband, because the first time that I ever saw the actress that played Angela on television was in an old comedy that was on NBC called 227. And her boyfriend in the comedy was called Calvin. I think that was just so cool to name him Calvin the way that her boyfriend on 227 was named Calvin. I thought that was cool. But when did you guys realize that Calvin and Dr. Manhattan were the same person? Did you think something was off before she goes and hits him on the head, or was that the moment you realized, oh crap, what just happened?
I think this was actually spoiled to me before I watched the show, so I guess I'm not a good person to gauge. But I do think there's hints throughout his arc throughout the series that you kind of start to figure it out.
Ryan, what about you?
I didn't see it coming at all. Maybe I wasn't really looking for that. I'm sure that you're right. I'm sure, Clarence, I'm sure there is stuff. I somehow didn't get it spoiled for me. I didn't even really, as bad as it sounds, I didn't really take into account Cal. He was just kind of a background character. He seemed to be, his role up until episode 6, 7, whatever it was, just seemed to be Angela's husband. The same. And I thought that they were kind of doing a thing where, you know, in most movies, you know, it's a male protagonist and he has his wife and that's kind of the extent of her character. I thought it was going to be all about her. So when, you know, she smacks him in the head with a hammer and then that blue glow comes from off screen, I thought that was super effective. That my jaw hit the floor. It totally took me by surprise.
Wow.
Yeah. See, I didn't get anything weird with him. I will agree with everything Ryan just said. The only thing I will add, the thing that did not fit well for me, and I don't mean it as I had a problem with it, as in I did not understand, because they did not give any context to it. They never explained where the kids came from. You know, obviously, they did.
So it was one of the day that Angela got shot and also the sheriff got shot.
The White Knight.
Yeah. What's that, Senate?
The White Knight.
Yeah. Was the name of the event, was it? Wasn't it when the, basically
right,
the Klan.
Sorry, went, I didn't. When okay. the Klan broke in and killed everyone.
Okay, I didn't catch the White Knight. Okay. And yeah, so another fellow police officer who she was friends with got killed as well, and they had kids. So that's where the kids came from.
Ah, okay. So I missed that. Well, they were the – I must not have been paying attention at that point. But they are the point to where it didn't make sense to me. But with him, I thought he was just the loving husband in the background until she slapped him in the head. So I'm assuming based on that, she knew the whole time that he was Dr. Manhattan, right? It wasn't so.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, remember the meeting in Saigon where they sit at the table? That's when they fall in love. He's Dr. Manhattan then, because it's like Dr. Manhattan Day or something and everybody's dressed up. And she first thinks he's just somebody dressed up trying to impress her.
So is that him and whenever I say him, is that the actor that, even though they don't show his face, is that the actor that is in Vietnam with her before he takes on the look of the dead body? Or is that another actor? Because going back and listening to it again, the voice sounds maybe more like the actor moderated his voice a little bit to sound a little different than, and he deepened it a little bit. You know, whenever he starts talking normally. Did you guys think that was a different actor portraying him before he took on the different form?
He sounded the same to me, so I don't know.
See, I thought he sounded kind of almost the same.
It sounded like the same actor, but modulated differently. Like maybe they ran his voice through something to give it a little bit of like almost, I don't know, like electric magnetic feedback. It felt a little bit ethereal. It felt a little bit otherworldly, but I still heard his voice in there.
Cool. And I think that's why they never let you see the face when he wasn't Dr. Manhattan, you know, whenever it wasn't him, was so that you could get that feeling of maybe he did look different, because obviously he was supposed to have looked different if he's taking on the form of somebody else.
No, I think so. I think you're right.
What did you guys think of the Calvary's attempt and ultimately Lady True's attempt to take his power? That was what this was all leading up to, was to basically destroy him and take his power. So let's go with the Calvary, specifically the senator deciding, I'm going to ascend to be Dr. Manhattan.
Well, again, if you go to the point where you don't think Dr. Manhattan's doing enough to help the world, it makes some sense for somebody else who's going to be more willing to help people to have it. But I don't think this is the guy. And I think also the fact that he's the only real superhero that's there, everybody else is normal, would make sense that they're going after him to pursue this power. And maybe he needs to be more active to help the world. I don't know.
I think it made a lot of sense because, you know, Lady True is Ozymandias' daughter, therefore the smartest person in the world. And if I think it's very relatable that if the smartest person in the world knew that, but for all intents and purposes, whatever you want to call him, a god was living in Tulsa, Oklahoma as a human and not using his powers for anything, they're so arrogant, Ozymandias and Lady True both, that they think that the power is better off in their hands. That is the best way to achieve their goal. So I thought that rang really, pardon the phrase, but rang really true when she went to steal it from him, because that's exactly what that character would want to do, is to, you know, you've done everything that a human can do. She's, whatever they say, she's 30 some odd years old and she's a trillionaire. She's done everything she can do as a human that she would want to ascend to godhood. So I thought that worked really well.
All right. So for me, the whole concept of taking his powers, regardless of which one it was, to me was like, this is classic comic book trope. I'm thinking Dr. Doom, and Dr. Doom sees power. What does he want to do? Who better than Doom? I want it. You know, if it's the Beyonder, I want it. If it's the Silver Surfer, I want it. It's who better than Doom? So this was kind of like my who better than Doom moment. One of the funny things that I thought about when the senator was about to take the power of Dr. Manhattan and he's basically derobing, they put him in these weird looking trunks before he takes the power. And I thought that was really funny, specifically because when you put Dr. Manhattan first in DC Comics proper, I think it was in Rebirth, for the first time, you had clothed Dr. Manhattan and he had these weird looking black trunks on. And so I thought that was a cool nod to the comic book of putting this other guy in these same weird looking black trunks before he takes the power. I thought that was funny.
And also, those are straight out of the original comic series in a few, not in very much, but in a few panels when you see him in Vietnam. He's also in the super weird trunks and you see kind of how silly he looks in them. And he looks actually way more, I don't want to say interesting, but he looks way more godly when he's just nude in the comic, because he obviously wouldn't care about being modest.
And I guess in the series, he, the actor, speaking of modesty, obviously had to be comfortable with himself, because he was definitely modest whichever the word is supposed to be, in the episode that they showed him. What about the ending? I think we've pretty much gotten up to the ending here. Were you satisfied with how the story wrapped up at the end? Clarence, what say you? Were you satisfied with how it ended?
I think I am. I think you can look at this story as a whole complete thing. Now, I know people want more, another series. I don't think Damon Lindelof is coming back. But you know, I think for what it was, it completely told his story in 9 episodes, no less. So I think it wrapped up well.
All right. Ryan, what say you?
I agree. I think, you know, if you would have gone into episode 8 or 9, you know, at the beginning, you would think, how on earth are they going to wrap this up in a satisfying way? And the fact they were able to is super laudable. Like, I think it's very impressive that they were able to do this, but also just super satisfying the way this was able to end. And, you know, at the end with the egg, I think eggs and motherhood were another big theme of this show. The egg motif kept coming back, almost like the clock motif in the original book. So, and kind of leaving it ambiguous at the end was kind of the classic Lindelof touch. But the way everything wrapped up towards the end and the last final shots of the show, I thought really brought, in a weird way, it brought everyone's character full circle.
All right. So I'm going to agree with what you guys just said. I didn't expect to have 9 episodes be so good of a containment of a story, and it did do that. I honestly wouldn't think I would want to see a continuation of the story, because I'm afraid by the way it ended, I would be afraid or fear that it would water down and lessen the story that we were told. And I think it was told so well that I don't want to see, per se, any more, at least to my knowledge. You might could come out with something else and I'd be equally blown away. I will say, for a positive note, that I never, as from the beginning of this podcast saying, really cared for some of these characters. And I went back and read some of Doomsday Clock again, and I realized that this has changed my perception of Dr. Manhattan and changed my perception and removed some of the negative thoughts or opinions or whatever that I had toward the characters. And that was cool. So it was nice to be able to, you know, see a different take on the characters. And I think that was good. So
just real quick, I agree with what you said about Dr. Manhattan, because as much as I love the book and for whatever the movie is, I never really connected with that character. And I think that's kind of the point in the book. But, you know, they talk about his time powers where he sees his entire life basically all at one moment. He sees all these different times at once. And I don't know, that's kind of a big comic book idea that I was never able to really wrap my head around when I was reading. But I felt like the show did it in such a way that really explained how this being would see the world around him in a way that, I agree with you, it has positively affected how I will go back and reread Watchmen the next time I read it, because I'm going to be able to connect with how that character understands things even more.
Interesting. Very good point. Very good point of view. Because I think, coming from a Doctor Who background, you know, but what I call the before Chibnall era of Doctor Who, the Doctor always made references to like how he perceived time. And one of his quotes I remember him saying was, all that is, all that was, all that ever could be was what he could see. But this takes that in a completely different direction, because he's not seeing time. He's in time, experiencing it all at once at the same time. And I think they portrayed that in this series very, very well. All right. So I want to give this one a rating, and I want to give a final rating of a 1 out of 5. And I'll start it off. I'm going to say that I would give this a 4.5. Because nothing is perfect, but I enjoyed it. I learned something about history. I like a character that I never liked before. So I'm going to give it a 4.5. So Clarence, what say you?
I'm going to give it a 3.8. And it sounds bad, but I really did enjoy the series. There are a few things I didn't like about it. A few choices, which I know for a stylistic purpose, they added in there, which, you know, was fine. So I don't know. I felt it was good, but not great. So just 3.8.
All right. Ryan, what say you?
I agree with you that, you know, nothing's perfect. But in kind of the context of, I wouldn't change anything about this book, about this show. And it has given me a higher reverence for a book that I already hold in very high regard. I'm going to give it a 5. I really think.
Oh, wow.
I really think that, you know, if you can stand shoulder to shoulder with the original book that is so revered by so many people and really add so much to the world and bring so much more to these characters and everything, that it's very impressive, the show, to me. And it's my favorite show that I've watched in probably the last couple of years. I really, really enjoyed this season of television.
Awesome. Awesome. So as we close out this episode, guys, I want to ask you one final question to close the episode. And that is, what else are you reading or watching that you would like to share with the audience? Reading or watching? And Clarence, why don't you go first?
Before I tell you that, I just want to give one quick shout out to the Looking Glass. That was one of my favorite characters in the series. He was freaking awesome. At first, I thought he was going to be like a Rorschach knockoff, kind of, which he sort of was, I guess. But I really liked this character. I liked how he was affected by the event in 1985 that Ozymandias did in New York. I really like how they're showing that event is permeated throughout the current state of the world, and he's still doing it. So,
indeed.
Yeah, I really loved his character in this series. He's probably one of my favorites.
Sweet, sweet.
What I'm reading or watching, I'm going to say check out, if you're not a Breaking Bad fan, and I don't know why you're not, the show is awesome, definitely check it out. But I'm watching Better Call Saul now, which is a prequel to that series, and it just keeps getting better. It's on Netflix. I haven't started on the latest season, but man, I'm really enjoying that. So that's going to be my recommended watch.
All right.
Better Call Saul.
All right. So I've never broke bad before, and I've always thought that that was not a series that I would enjoy. So Clarence, you know me pretty well. Would I enjoy that?
The first season is only 7 episodes. Okay. Just watch it. And if you hate it, just leave it and never watch it again, but it's really good.
All right. All right. So Ryan, what are you watching or reading that you would like to share?
I'm going to stay kind of on brand with the rest of the episode. I picked up this book a little while ago at a Barnes and Noble off the kind of the discount shelf or whatever. And it's called Watching the Watchmen. And it's kind of an oversized coffee table sized book, but it was done by Dave Gibbons, the artist behind the original Watchmen. And it's kind of a documentation of his process working, because Alan Moore refuses to talk to anybody about Watchmen. He won't take any checks on Watchmen. He's distanced himself completely. But Dave Gibbons kind of wrote this book and included a ton of his early sketches, kind of explaining, how he came up with the design for Rorschach. And some of the early, if you go back and look at his early sketches, Rorschach, he, instead of having a Rorschach mask, he was in a skin tight suit that changed all the time. So you really get to see the creative process here. And I think it's a super interesting additive to the text of Watchmen and the show. So that would be my recommendation. It's called Watching the Watchmen by Dave Gibbons.
So if I were to say, what am I watching or reading? I would probably say right now, The Walking Dead. I'm so glad The Walking Dead is back from its hiatus. I've already seen tonight's episode and I really enjoyed it. So yeah, The Walking Dead. That's what I'm watching right now. Alrighty. Thanks everyone for listening. We appreciate you listening. And as always, we will be back next time.
You've been listening to the Discussing Network. Find out more at discussingnetwork.com.